You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, May 7th, 2020. I'm Michael Brooks, broadcasting from the quarantine zone. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. Very far from the industrially ravaged canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On this week's program, on today's program, Guillermo Long, former foreign minister of Ecuador, senior analyst at the Center for Economic and Policy Research. We're talking about the mercenaries in Venezuela, the recent extremely questionable conviction, lawfare conviction of former Ecuadorian President Rafael Correa. What is lawfare in Latin America? Covering all of that with him. 3.2 million more Americans claim unemployment. Staggering numbers. We're up to 33 million in 7 weeks. The Trump administration is shelving Center for Disease Control guidelines on reopening the country as they recklessly push forward. The Trump's allies on the Hill, including Tom Cotton, Josh Hawley, Ted Cruz and Chuck Grassley, see an opportunity to attack immigrants, and they're taking it. What was Silvercorp, the mercenary firm involved in this attempted coup in Venezuela? What were they doing in Brazil in 2018? New piece in Brazil Wire documents their presence. Pompeo continuing to escalate with China. He's accusing it of withholding key information. Bill Barr is urging a tactical shift in the Trump administration's effort to strike down key provisions in Obamacare. Justice Department investigates Blue Flame Medical after claims that it failed to provide masks in Maryland. And Brazil's COVID cases are rising. Iran is under threat of a resurgence, no small part due to U.S. sanctions. Top Republican fundraiser and Trump ally named Postmaster General, giving the president new influence over the post office. And Iraq has formed a new government after 6 months of uncertainty. And everybody's, well, maybe you haven't, but there is a video of a cold-blooded murder of a 25-year-old black man jogging in Georgia, and no charges have been brought up in this case yet. All that and much, much more on today's Majority Report. So we want to actually start with this, this case in Georgia. And, you know, individual cases of horrific and despicable things happening are important in and of themselves, but the point here is to find a theme and a structure. And we have seen multiple cases where, I mean, there's the issue of police violence, which is a problem in this country systemically, relating to over-incarceration, and it distributes across all states and all lower class populations, of course, disproportionately people of color as well. Then there's a case like this, which has extensive connection to law enforcement, which you'll see in this clip, but this is just an act of terrorism. It's a hate crime. It's an act of terrorism. It's there for everybody to see, and we don't have any charges. So we're going to start with a clip here from Ahmaud Arbery's family's a lawyer, explaining the case here, the facts of the case, and the lack of charges. Let's play that clip.
Joining me now is Wanda Cooper, Ahmaud's, Arbery's mother, and S. Lee Merritt, the attorney for Mr. Arbery's family. Tell me, Attorney Merritt, what happened here and why haven't we not seen a grand jury convened to really go through the facts here when we have an unarmed young man jogging that's dead?
What you have was three Southern Georgian white citizens who essentially put together a posse and lynched a young man in broad daylight. Ahmaud Arbery, by all accounts, even those of his accusers, was seen running down the road. He was wearing sneakers and exercise gear. He was not carrying any firearms, or he wasn't carrying any stolen material. The worst that could be said about him was that he stopped at a home that was under construction and that he allegedly looked in through the window before carrying on his jog. The reason that we have not seen an indictment, in my opinion, is because these men were white. These men have strong law enforcement ties. The father, Gregory McMichael, being law enforcement for 30 years, specifically working in the district attorney's office, who would have been responsible for arresting these men. That DA recused herself. It passed over to the next county, and there the district attorney failed to disclose his close ties to this family. Ms. Cooper, in her diligence and her family, discovered those ties and asked that he recuse himself. He did, but not before offering a very poor opinion on a state of the law that would have justified the shoot.
So we're waiting here, and that's sort of the bottom line. That is the bottom line. You can. We're not going to play this video. You can see it if you want. It's could not be more clear what happened here. This young man is out jogging. These guys pull up on him in a truck, ask for him to stop, come over, and then end up murdering him in cold blood. And there's no doubt, obviously, one of these people who murdered him was a 30-year veteran, as the attorney pointed out there, of the local police department. There's connections with the DA. And now we're waiting on a grand jury. One thing we wanted to just highlight, in addition to the courage of this family and how important this case is, and obviously we'll keep following it, but the attorney there who's doing his job, to speak with precision, but just the idea that the only thing, because supposedly what these guys were doing was looking for a burglar. Now, why this was their responsibility, why you wouldn't just call the police, why you would think a burglar was out jogging, obviously all of these things speak to, in fact, the racial terrorism of the incident. But he felt the need to say the only thing you could say about Ahmaud Arbery was that he looked inside a house that was under construction. Brendan and Matt, have you guys, let's do like the full span here. As a kids, have you ever, I don't know, maybe even like gone trespassed on a construction site that you weren't supposed to because it was interesting or you want to check out what's going on? I definitely have. And today as adults, do you guys ever like walk up by construction sites and look inside them?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like realtors don't mind people doing that, like as if they're prospective buyers. And yeah, I mean, I grew up in a new development, so everything around me was new houses. And I went inside of those things all the time. I mean, yeah. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, this is just a very plain example of examining one's own privilege. Because I know my grandparents lived in a community in South Carolina, not far from where this was. And they're always doing construction down there. It's always being done. And there are always people out walking about because it's nice out generally. And like, it's not unusual for people to just look in to someone's house.
Right. So a completely normal behavior that indicates absolutely nothing, that almost
totally
any
irrelevant
human,
to
completely
like
completely irrelevant.
Yeah.
Normal, you would track it. Someone taking a run and checking out a new developed house is, there's nothing exceptional or interesting or relevant about it. But this good attorney who was taking on some obviously very dangerous forces there in Georgia, feels a need to clock that. And he's probably right. But we all need to take the lesson, you know, what the lesson and the upshot of that is, which is that even in a context where you're talking about a young black man murdered in cold blood while he's out running, taking a run, that something completely irrelevant and innocuous that he did still has to be acknowledged as a point of contention in a crime where there is the murder video, there is the ISIS video. So we will continue following that case. And obviously, you know, what else can you say? It's just, it's evil. It's despicable. It reflects much bigger problems and serious danger and inequity. And also one can only imagine, I mean, to go through that as a family, your son is murdered in cold blood. And the murderers are insulated, at least so far. I mean, we're waiting on a grand jury. Maybe, you know, as we say, hope springs eternal, something will come forward as a result of this becoming a national media story. Anyway, and this is not, you know, this is one I, and obviously I'm not a lawyer, but I can't, I don't see, there was another clip where they, with the same attorney, where they quoted from a Charles Blow column, essentially saying that, you know, in some cases like this, what has happened is obvious and the moral consequence is obvious, but there's a technicality. I don't see any technicality here. Anyways, we are going to get straight to our guest who is joining us now from, I believe, from Washington, D.C.
I'll admit him now.
Oh, okay, you'll admit him now. Sorry, I just got the IM.
Yep.
Of course, you should. Okay, joining us now, connecting as we speak, real-time production. Is okay. Yes, is Guillermo Long. He's a former foreign minister for Ecuador, and he's now a policy analyst based in Washington. Guillermo, are you there?
Yeah. Hi, Michael. Can you hear me? Can you see me?
Cannot see you. Can hear you very well.
Okay. Is that better?
Well, now you're to the side. Is there a way? I don't know if we could make
your phone is sideways.
Yeah, it's a horizontal shot instead of a vertical. Or there we go.
Perfect.
Hey, okay. And tilt down. I think that's good. Okay, Kieran, thanks so much for being here.
No, thank you for having me on the show.
How is everything there? I hope everybody is safe and okay, as we always say to everybody when they join us.
We're fine. Yeah, thank you very much. How about yourself?
Absolutely, we're okay. You know, it's still pretty intense here in New York, but thankfully we're okay so far. So mercenaries caught trying by basically apparently pointed out by fishermen in Venezuela, engaged with by the Venezuelan military. It turns out they're part of a mercenary firm called Silver Corps. Can you talk about this coup attempt in Venezuela? And how you think it fits with this, you know, broader Trump administration efforts in Latin America. And also, we'll talk about it later. I mean, there's some reporting that Silver Corps was president in Brazil in 2018. What is the role of these mercenary firms in this type of foreign policy today?
Yeah, so I think essentially a global phenomenon. You're getting more and more privatization of military or paramilitary presence around the world. It's something the United States has been well accustomed to now for several decades, but it's been on the rise in the last, well, this century probably. And it's kind of a great way of, you know, I mean, well, history and hopefully sooner than history, journalists will eventually uncover to what extent this, the current U.S. administration was involved in this particular attempt at a coup, at an invasion, at an assassination, whatever it was, in Venezuela. But certainly more generally, it's a great way of, you know, if it succeeds, claiming victory. And if it fails, sort of, oh, I had nothing to do with this kind of response, which is what we got from the current Trump administration this time around. So it's a useful tool because you can, you know, not be seen as being directly involved unless you want to be directly involved because the operation is successful. And, you know, it's something which, when I was at the UN, is constantly on the agenda. So countries from the global south are constantly complaining about this. There's an actual item in the UN and the Human Rights Council on mercenaries, because it's been something recurrent in Africa, very recurrent in Africa. So African countries, it's a big deal for them. And it's something that's been recurrent also in Latin America. Cuba's had a long history of sort of private, you know, privateers. I mean, obviously going back to the Bay of Pigs, but even after that, sort of operating against Cuban installations, Cuban citizens, and so on. And then, you know, the CIA saying, oh, or the United, or the US administration saying, oh, but they have nothing to do with us. But then eventually you inevitably, you know, establish strong links. A lot of these people are either, you know, vets or former CIA agents, or, you know, all the, I mean, there are sort of incestuous links often between these private security corporations and the state actors fundamentally. And we're seeing in this case again, you know, these links exist, to what extent they acted with the permission or even the encouragement of the US administration remains unclear. I have my suspicion, you know, I suspect that if they were more successful, maybe the Trump administration would have said, you know, oh, well, we knew all along, you know, that's the way, that's the game that is played usually in these cases.
Mike Pompeo said at a briefing yesterday, you know, hey, if it was us, would have gone much different.
That's right. Yeah. So, yeah, right. Absolutely. I mean, I think you're right now, the U.S. administration has made it clear that, you know, it's looking for regime change pretty much through any means possible. All options are on the table, which is the language that's being used. So if all options are on the table, then surely this is one of them, right? So again, you know, I can't make specific accusations yet, right. But I'm very concerned that over the coming months, particularly as we get closer to the elections in the United States, particularly if the Trump administration slides in the polls, and if, you know, if Trump slides in the polls in terms of his numbers, you know, coming November, I'm very concerned about a potential escalation with regards to Venezuela, even, you know, military intervention of some kind of or another in Venezuela. And I think it would be obviously tragic. Because it would be violent, it would imply the loss of lives, an important loss of lives. And I think it would be a major misjudgment on behalf of this administration if they do that. We're hearing a lot of noise comparing this to Panama, you know, in the late 80s. It's not, Venezuela is not Panama.
Right.
And, you know, Panama, when Bush Sr. Invaded in December 1989, had 2.5 million inhabitants, right? It has 4 million inhabitants now. It had 2.5 million inhabitants then. Venezuela's got 28 million inhabitants. That's larger than what Iraq had in 2003, right? So I think those numbers are important. And also, you know, a lot of people hate Maduro in Venezuela, but a lot of people love Maduro in Venezuela. Right? It's a very polarized society. It's a very politicized society. It's a society. It's a country that's been preparing for this kind of intervention now for years, both at the military level, but also at the militia level. You know, this would be a huge quagmire for the United States. A big deal, a big problem. And it would be, you know, a tragedy for Venezuela, for Latin America, as well as, you know, a broken taboo, because there's never been a U.S. direct military intervention in South America. There have been plenty of U.S. military interventions in Central America and the Caribbean, but there's never been one in South America. And that's for a reason, right? There are larger countries with larger populations further away from the immediate backyard, as it used to be known, as it's still unfortunately known in some quarters. So anyway, sorry for that long.
No, that's really important.
Source of concern, yeah.
Yeah, no, that's really important. So that, again, the moral calculus of Grenada or Panama is obvious in terms of just the, you know, the imperialist behavior, the loss of civilian life, the geopolitical implications. And then from just a military standpoint, sure, you can, you know, you can do that. You can be a bully in that sense. Venezuela logistically and materially would be a completely different thing. In terms of just the consequence of actually doing that. That's really important for people to know, that it's first and foremost, you know, of course, a moral objection, but that this wouldn't be something that, oh, they shouldn't do that. That's too bad. You know, this would have immediate and very serious consequences, you know, across the region that's our region.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you're absolutely right. There are ethical sort of dimensions to this. You know, I don't think the United States should be imposing these sanctions on Venezuela. It shouldn't be strangling Venezuelan economy and the Venezuelan social reality the way it's doing. It's doing a lot of harm. It's killing tens of thousands of people. There are several serious studies, including one from the center that I work for, Center for Economic Policy Research, that demonstrates that this is having these dire effects on the Venezuelan population. And certainly if it escalates this further into a military territory, then, you know, it's going to be, there's already a crisis with Venezuelan migration in the region. It would make this crisis much bigger. You know, you would be looking at sort of, I don't like these comparisons, but sort of Syria style, you know, on that kind of scale in terms of refugees. It would be very harmful for neighboring countries, and it would create war economies on the borders with Venezuela for the neighboring countries as well. So, you know, ethically, in terms of human suffering and in terms of the illegitimacy, I would say, of such an imperial operation, then there are massive issues. But if you look at it even from the standpoint of empire and from the United States, I think it would be a huge strategic mistake. Venezuela is not Panama, as you just said. It's certainly not Grenada. That's an even more extreme example. It has an even smaller population. And if you look at Venezuela over the last few years, all the coup attempts that have been very much encouraged by the United States and the U.S. administration, politically, but probably also with significant logistical support, they've failed. And
can you take us through a history, a kind of just a brief primer on just how many coup attempts, or, you know, give us a real sense of that, because the Venezuelan government is very resilient to these.
That's right. I think that's the key word. It's very resilient. And the more you have coups, the more you have coup attempts, the more resilient it becomes. But it's obvious, you know, it's kind of like a vaccine against the next coup, right? Because every time there's a coup attempt, people have to show their true colors and their true cards, right? So every time a faction of the military rebels against the Venezuelan government, that faction of the military is not going to rebel again, right? It's just been, that's it. It's isolated. It's, you know, you can only attempt a coup once if you're a military officer, right? So last year, 2019 was the year of the multiple coup attempts. I mean, and you'll remember from essentially a year ago, a little bit before, from February onwards, you know, it was perceived that this was the moment to do this. There was this big attempt to get humanitarian aid through Cúcuta, and this big concert, and the roads to Venezuela were all cut off, you know, this kind of, I mean, it was actually fake aid, you know, essentially. And, you know, and kind of laughable quantities of aid, even if you consider that aid to have been genuine, it was like $20-25 million compared to the billions and billions of costs for the Venezuelan economy in terms of the cost of the sanctions, of the economic sanctions. It's quite hypocritical. You know, I bring aid, tiny amount of aid with my right hand, but with my left hand, I'm, you know, strangling the Venezuelan economy. And it's when all these key political actors sort of gambled that the time was ripe and it looked like the Venezuelan government might fall. So all sorts of actors, you know, from pop stars to senators, people like Marco Rubio, but also the Secretary General of the OAS, they all went to the border. Several Latin American presidents went to the border. And this started a wave, I would say, an ongoing coup attempt that lasted several months. So there were several peaks to that, but essentially, a coup attempt that lasted. I mean, the last one was when Leopoldo López, actually one of the sort of radical opposition figures from a minority party, from Guaido's party, supposedly Guaido's boss, actually, because he's the head of the party, tried to organize a coup and eventually ended up in hiding in the Spanish embassy. And so, you know, this exhausted from the perspective of the Venezuelan opposition and some of its military allied, a lot of the possibilities from their point of view of toppling the Maduro government. It was actually quite remarkable. For a while, Guaido was sort of... So the self-proclaimed president of Venezuela, Juan Guaido, was sort of, I would say, neutralized in his capacity to do anything. And then the Venezuelan government has kind of decided to let him operate, which again is quite singular because, you know, when you have if this is a dictatorship, then why are they letting this person calling himself a president and openly calling for the demise of the regime and calling for coups to happen, you know, to operate within Venezuela.
And travel internationally. I mean, go get a standing ovation at the State of the Union, meet with leaders in Europe, meet with Justin Trudeau. I mean, that doesn't, you know, again, it's not, I think we're complexifying Venezuela like any other government. Of course, there's problems, but the idea that this is, I mean, forget quote unquote dictatorships. I mean, you couldn't do this in the United States. This is a very rare behavior to be lenient about.
It's a very, very strange situation. I mean, it's a complete, hybrid situation in Venezuela. And the Venezuelan government has made the political choice to let Guaido operate. Obviously he cannot do much because he doesn't exert any sovereignty. I mean, this is, again, we could go Guaido has achieved a lot internationally, relatively speaking, but very little domestically. So internationally, I mean, you know, it's unbelievable. But at the Organization of American States, it's Guaido's representative who sits where Venezuela, who represents the state of Venezuela. Whereas at the UN, a few hundred kilometers north of Washington in New York, it's the Maduro government that has its representative at the United Nations. Why? Because the UN, as the guardian of international law, knows that in order to be the representative of your government, the United Nations, you have to exert de facto sovereignty, right? It doesn't matter what kind of regime you have. I mean, it might matter for all sorts of other things. So you might get attacked on the human rights record. But in terms of who is represented at the United Nations, you have to exert sovereignty, real sovereignty, de facto sovereignty. So control of territory, control of institutions, control of the armed forces, control of the police, control of the country, right? And we all know that Maduro controls the country, whereas Guaido doesn't. But at the Organization of American States, which is a less rigorous organization, very politicized, very sort of hawkish, serving fundamentally the interests of the United States, it is Guaido's representative that, you know, who sits there. So it's.
Can you talk more about the OAS? I think this is important to spend a few minutes on, and maybe you can also, remind us of the work you did, with with the Center for Economic and Policy Research right out of the gate. I mean, you know, it was very clear, obviously, that it was a coup in Bolivia, but the OAS has historical ties to the United States, obviously, but potentially, I've heard some people, you know, obviously historical ties, but that even that more recently, it's they've gotten even tighter with the U.S. in terms of some of this kind of renewed aggression in Latin America. But maybe, can you just speak specifically to the OAS role here in more general terms?
Yeah, so the Organization of American States, OAS, which is actually physically located a few hundred meters away across the lawn from the White House in a very pretty prestigious building that was donated by Carnegie, is it?
Carnegie, sure. Yeah, I think so.
I'd have to check. Yeah, anyway, yeah. Great marble.
Sounds plausible, yeah.
Yeah, the great marble building just across from the White House. Was from its very conception in 1948, essentially an organization that was meant to keep the Western Hemisphere united in the Cold War, right? So that was the prime role of the OAS during the Cold War. And as soon as the Cold War was over, the OAS really essentially sort of struggled to identify its new role in the international system. You know? So when Cuba turned communist, in inverted commas, 1962, Cuba was chucked out because, and this is actually literally what the resolution said, the inter-American system was incompatible with Marxism-Leninism. So out you go, right? But when all these terrible dictatorships emerged in Latin America, military dictatorships, mostly in the 1960s and 70s, that was fine. Right. So it wasn't based on democracy, on human rights, on all these kind of values. It was based on the fight against communism. Now, when the Cold War came to an end, the OAS really tried to go back to trying to having this kind of democratic legitimacy. Right. So it wasn't hampered by this fight against communism anymore. So it became it really tried to be the sort of an organization that would defend the values of democratic capitalism, right? Except it had a very poor legacy. And so it really struggled to do that. Essentially, it succeeded in doing a small part of that by establishing strong institutions that would monitor elections. So that was kind of its joker. And the OAS managed to become an expert at electoral monitoring, electoral observing, which it did fairly successfully. Technically, it became very well known globally for having sort of high standards at electoral observation. Now, eventually, in the 21st century, when a lot of Latin American government turned to the left, you know, at one point you had, you know, 2009, which was the apex of this. Depending on how you count these countries, you'd have between 12 and 14 Latin American governments were left of center, right? Some of them quite radically so. So that changed. For the first time in history, you had an OAS Secretary General elected in 2005 who wasn't supported by the United States. This had never happened before. And this person was reelected. José Miguel Insulza was reelected in 2010 against the will of the United States once again. So, you know, that didn't happen before. But then when the tide turned back to the right, so roughly 2014, 2015 in Latin America, you know, this new Secretary General of the OAS, Luis Almagro, who had been elected actually with the support of the left in Latin America, sort of adapted to the new circumstances and became extremely pro-US and extremely hawkish. So you've got a return right now to this OAS playing the role that it was playing in the 60s and 70s, essentially a Cold War OAS. So trying to isolate Venezuela, trying to isolate Nicaragua, starting to fight against Cuba, when the OAS had essentially dropped that battle and in fact had invited Cuba back in 2009. Cuba said, no, we don't want back in the OAS. That was Cuba's decision. But in 2009, the OAS invited Cuba back to be a member of the organization. So, but you know, you're seeing something which actually Secretary of State Pompeo celebrated in a February speech in the OAS, celebrating the return of the OAS to, I think I quote exactly, the good days of the 1950s and 1960s. Something very similar to that, right? So, you know, right. This is, so it's the OAS of the Cold War, trying to isolate the left, trying to prevent the left from returning to power in certain countries, actually even prepared to, I would say, jeopardizing some of the institutions that it had constructed, such as the Department for Electoral Observation. So you've had the most, I mean, you'd already had an example with Haiti in 2010, 2011, which where I think the OAS played a dirty role there. But, you know, this, the recent observation of the Bolivian elections last October was really anti-technical, really political, and eventually resulted in Evo Morales being toppled and having to go into exile. Why? Essentially because the process was politicized and they didn't do a technical job. They did a political job. They said there was, the OAS said there was fraud in Bolivia where there is clearly no evidence of such fraud. So to cut a long story short, I think we're seeing a return of the OAS playing the sort of pro-US, you know, Fidel Castro used to call the OAS the U.S. Ministry of its colonies, right? So, I mean, that's kind of become a bit of a slogan in the Latin American left, but certainly playing the Monroeist card, right? So trying to play the institution that helps the U.S. administer its backyard, essentially.
So connect this with this concept of lawfare. Which people certainly would, you know, from the coverage I've done and my perception of the situation in Brazil and the prosecution of President Lula, that these sort of particularly, I mean, Lava Jato in Brazil, but actually across Latin America, these sprawling anti-corruption investigations, which, you know, first of all, they do tend to start broad, but then target the left. And then at times, maybe they conflate, you know, corruption is such a big all-encompassing word that it confuses. But when people hear it, I think they think, oh, okay, corruption. That means that somebody took, you know, a health budget and washed it through a Swiss bank to, you know, put in real estate investments or something. But what it might mean is somebody, you know, just like in DC or anywhere else, political horse trading, working with the political realities of, you know, your given situation so you can govern. And I, you know, I say that all to say that I'd like you to maybe speak on the broader themes of that, but a case that we have not covered a lot, but I know is close to you because you served in his government, is a recent conviction in absentia. I mean, Rafael Correa is not in Ecuador for this. But charges against him by the current Lenin Moreno government. And I guess I'm wondering, first of all, you know, your sense of this lawfare role in terms of targeting the left in Latin America. And does the Correa case connect with that, or is that sort of on a different track? And you know, what do you think of the merits of that case?
Yeah, sure. I think it completely is, I mean, it's one of the archetypal example of the lawfare you've just described. Right. So, you know, going back to the coups of the 1960s and 1970s, it's probably not the preferred route to getting rid of the left, because it, you know, it's, well, I mean, the world has changed since 1967, 70s. It would look bad. And so there have been all sorts of different strategies in order to try and prevent the Latin American left from returning to power. And, you know, I think for the United States establishment, for the State Department, it was probably quite traumatic, and maybe it's a strong term, but maybe not, to have a majority of Latin American countries, you know, depending on, obviously, each country has different dates, but, you know, by and large, between 2000 and 2015, it was tough for U.S. imperialism in Latin America. Right. I mean, you had a lot of countries trying to establish sovereign institutions, sovereign states, and then sovereign even regional institutions, creating alternatives to the OAS, not really playing the neoliberal game, not wanting the IMF in, not really wanting the World Bank in. Obviously, it'll depend from one country to the other, but, you know, by and large, this was not, and bringing China in as well as an important partner, diversifying relations. being very critical of the United States in multilateral fora. You know, this was not, these were not good times for U.S. Domination in its backyard. And they haven't, they wait, you know, the United States essentially waited in different contexts. They had different strategies to try and turn that page. In some cases, such as in Argentina, they found sort of poster boys of neoliberalism that they could support, like Macri. In other cases, they couldn't win electorally. So they even organized coups, you know, in some cases. But, you know, and every single example is going to be different. But certainly lawfare has been a way of making sure that the threats, so the Lulas and the Correas of this world, cannot be elected. I think Lula and Correa are perfect examples of this. Lula was essentially in jail, held on bogus charges in order for him not to be able to run, because all the polls confirmed that he would win and he would have won easily against Bolsonaro. And Correa, very similarly, he's not been in jail, but he's been abroad. He didn't flee Ecuador. He was already abroad when the trouble started because his wife is Belgian. So he announced before his term came to an end that he would be living in Belgium once he left the presidency. And it's exactly what he did. A few days after handing over the presidency to his successor, he left to Belgium, and the sort of lawfare caught him already outside of the country. And essentially the purpose of that lawfare has been to prevent him from coming back. So the problem is, of course, throughout Latin America, and that includes Ecuador, the return of neoliberalism is extremely unpopular. And you will recall that in 2019, last year, we saw a number of historic protests spread like wildfire throughout the region against essentially neoliberal reform, right? Neoliberal structural adjustment programs accompanied by the IMF. So you have them in Ecuador, the biggest protests in certainly in my lifetime, you know, in my generation, but also in Chile, in Colombia, in Haiti, and a number of countries. In some countries where there were electoral outlets for people to express themselves politically, such as in Argentina, the left came back in, right? And if you look at the polls, certainly that's the case in Ecuador. Correa, if he was on the ticket tomorrow, he would win with a landslide. So they're very worried about that in Ecuador. We've got presidential and congressional, we call it National Assembly in Ecuador, but essentially congressional elections in February next year, so very soon. And Correa would be likely to win if he could run. So Moreno did two things. The current president of Ecuador, Lenin Moreno, did two things in order to avoid Correa from coming back. The first thing was to reform the constitution and prevent re-election. So re-election is now banned in Ecuador, so Correa can't run. However, he could run as vice president, and that would obviously boost the ticket, whoever the presidential candidate would be. With Correa as vice president, that would, you know, obviously boost the ticket. Another alternative would be for Correa to run as a member of the National Assembly of Congress, right? And that would also sort of boost the party, also probably boost the presidential vice presidential ticket, and mean that it would probably lead to a parliamentary majority, which would be very important, right? So they're stopping him from doing this. They've invented these bogus corruption charges. It's really incredible. I mean, I don't know, can't go into too much detail, but one of the proofs against Correa is a notebook written by one of his advisors at the time, who claims that she's written all the amounts that were received for illegal campaign financing in this notebook, right? This is the mother of all proofs. And she originally said, well, the notebook is dated 2014. Today, I have received such and such an amount, you know, I've received so many thousands of dollars, and it's all down to the common sense and everything. And then the next day, today I've received so many from so-and-so. And she claimed originally that this was with presidential knowledge. So the Correa knew about this. But then it was proven that the notebook, written supposedly in 2014, came out of the press in 2018. So she changed the story, said, oh, no, I remembered this, and I wrote it on a flight one day from Quito, a 45-minute flight.
Wait, I'm saying you mean literally like the press that physically makes the notebooks?
The notebook.
Okay, just so people are clear. It wasn't released to the press in 2018.
Oh, no, sorry.
The physical object was not produced till 4 years later. Okay, yeah, go ahead.
That's correct.
Okay.
So she had to change her story and said she'd written all this, you know, from memory, but, you know, down to the exact scent, the exact person. At 10 o'clock this morning, they came, they deposit, you know.
Probably not.
So, you know, it's a whole shambles. But the order to the judges, who are, you know, under strict control here by the government, is not to let Correa go. Now, there's an appeals process, which they're speeding up illegally, because if by September, mid-September of this year is when people will register their candidacies for the February elections. And if they don't have a final guilty verdict against Correa by September, you know, as in many parts of the world, once you've enrolled as a candidate, you're immune from prosecution, right? Until the elections are over. Otherwise, people would be persecuted left, right, and center in order to stop them from running. So from September onwards, you know, they need a guilty sentence before September so they can block Correa from participating. So there's already a verdict, if you like, 8 years in prison and 25 years taking away his political rights, which blocks him from running in any election. But that verdict, verdict can still be appealed, right? Until the appeals process is concluded, Correa could still technically be a candidate. So they're essentially rushing things. You know, so it was amazing because under this COVID-19 crisis, the whole judiciary is closed down unless these extremely urgent matters, you know, people who are in jail unjustly, you know, you can appeal and you'll be heard. But all the non-urgent matters have been sort of delayed. But this was not. The court case against Correa was, you know, everybody wore their masks and went to court. So this is a typical case of lawfare in order to stop essentially democracy, right? It's an anti-democratic case of lawfare. Yeah.
Spends just, I want to, actually, before, I want to get to China and Latin America, but just briefly, can you explain Lenin Moreno? Because this is an important character in the sense that he wasn't the party from the right that won. He actually was supposedly sort of going to carry on the Correa legacy, and he's reversed very aggressively. I mean, everything from the aiding in the political persecution of Julian Assange, which has implications for freedom of the press across the Western system, to you know, a total reversal, if my understanding is correct, on the real social gains that were made in Ecuador under the Correa government. So what is the, you know, what is the Moreno? And Lenin is not a mistake. He was named after Lenin. What happens?
It's actually not such an uncommon name in Ecuador, Lenin.
Oh, really? I thought he was actually named after the guy. No, no.
Yeah, yeah, of course. I mean, I'm sure.
Okay, but it's not. But a lot of people are doing this. Okay.
Yeah, that's right. Quite common. I wish I could explain it fully. I mean, obviously, been thinking about this for the last 3 years because it's been a major setback for Ecuador's political process. But essentially, Lenin is the archetypal historic sort of traitor, and there are a few throughout history. You know, you can think of a few of them. A Shakespearean traitor, right? So it's Trojan horse. Who was elected, he had been Correa's vice president, right, until 2013, sorry. You know, was Correa's handpicked successor, the party's handpicked successor. He was elected, he won the elections. And from the moment he was elected, from the moment he was sworn in, he started this 180-degree U-turn against Correa's policies, so including the economic and social policies, bringing back sort of neoliberal policies, deregulation, cutting back the role of the state, cutting back funding for social and for health and education. So we're, you know, one of the consequences, obviously, the COVID-19 crisis in Ecuador, because it's cut back massively the health sector. But also geopolitically. So, you know, sort of becoming really aligned with the Trump administration, going back to bilateralism, killing all of our initiatives in terms of Latin American integration. Ecuador was the seat of UNASUR, sort of the Brussels of this new South American Union. which was a very important project, one of our most important projects, on all sorts of levels, on development, on economics, but also geopolitically, in order to have more independence from the United States, and also more independence from anybody, you know, to sort of interact as a sovereign block of states in the international system. Well, you know, Ecuador got rid of not only its membership, but obviously it's the fact that it was the seat of this organization, which actually was also going to be very interesting for Ecuador in terms of its strategic integration in South America. You know, becoming the Brussels of South America is not necessarily a bad thing if you're a small country like Ecuador, right? So you got, you've already mentioned Assange. There's now a runway in the Galapagos Islands, which is extremely symbolic for Ecuador because the Galapagos Islands is like the one of the gems of, you know, Ecuadorian nationhood, if you like. And one of the runways is now being handed over basically to the, well, it's being used certainly by the US military, which is a big taboo, especially since the US had its biggest military base in South America was based in Ecuador until 2009, until Correa put an end to that. So that brings back sort of ghosts of the past, right? So all sorts, I mean, whichever sort of domain of public policy and you look at, there's been a massive U-turn. And because Correa is still the biggest threat to that, because Correismo as a political phenomenon and the Correa's political party, they've actually managed to take away the political party from Correa, but, you know, the movement still exists and would be the likely winner of next year's election. A lot of what Moreno's done is to persecute the followers of Rafael Correa and some of his closest collaborators. So a lot of people have had to flee into exile, including, you know, elected members of parliament, Congress, right? Yeah. So a number of them have fled. And there was a whole, I don't know if you remember, the last year there was a whole old deal with a number of members of Congress having to hide in the Mexican embassy, and then Mexico negotiating with Ecuador so that Ecuador could grant safe passage so that these people could actually go into asylum to Mexico. This eventually happened. Then you had elected officials from Correa's party, the equivalent of the governor of the state where the capital is in Ecuador, so it's a province called Pichincha, where Quito, the capital, is. So the governor of that state was arrested because she had supported supposedly the October protests. So they arrested her, like in the old days of the 60s and 70s, like they arrested her on rebellion, sort of like sedition, right? So, I mean, this is going back to the language of the persecutions against the left in the 60s and 70s. Really scary stuff, right? So that's been, sliding more and more into authoritarianism, essentially. And here there's a great contradiction because Lenin Moreno has been trying to portray Correa as this terrible dictator, and that he really means a return to this kind of patrician form of democracy, right? The democracy of the elites, the liberal pact of the elites. But on the other hand, in order to be able to do this so-called democratization, which I would seriously question, he's had to be more and more authoritarian, because if he allows democracy to prosper, Correismo would triumph. So this has been the situation, the cul-de-sac that Moreno has been in. And now on popularity or approval ratings, I mean, this was before the COVID-19 crisis, the latest polls, he was on 12%. So he's probably, he's probably even lower than that. And in Ecuador, we also measure credibility. So the question is, do you believe what the president says? And we've been doing it for 40 years or so. So it's interesting to see that evolve through time. And 7% of Ecuadorians believe what Moreno says. So he's probably the least believed, the least credible president since restoration of democracy in Ecuador after military rule in 1979. So that's how bad the situation is in Ecuador. Yeah.
So when you talk about China, you alluded to China earlier, and I've actually said in a way that I think people have misinterpreted that Chinese influence in Latin America is a good thing, not because I have some type of naive view of China or an idealized view of China. A lot of people actually sort of get complain on the other side of the equation when I criticize things about China. But that the point is that allowing for multipolarity in Latin America and the Caribbean gives more of a capacity for a Korea government, as an example, to choose its own way because there isn't one hegemonic presence sort of dominating everything. So what was that your sort of understanding of the importance, among other things, of cultivating a relationship with China, was just the idea that if Latin America is going to be genuinely independent and follow its own development path, it needs to broaden out its relationships with essentially places with a lot of capital and a lot of room to invest?
Yes, I think that, I mean, essentially the point you've made is correct. I mean, not having all your eggs in the same baskets, we say in Ecuador. Right. So, you know, in terms of your foreign policy, in terms of your alliances, is really important. And breaking that sort of historic dependency with the United States. I mean, we always told, I mean, when I was foreign minister, we always told the United States, we want a great relationship with the United States. And lots of things we admire about the United States. And in fact, there were even some things that we, in our policies, that we thought, oh, look, that's how they did it in the United States. That worked. Maybe we can replicate this. You know, there was no sort of visceral anti-Americanism. Before I was foreign minister, I worked in the higher education system. I was minister for a while there, and there were lots of things about the U.S. universities. Some things we didn't replicate because we didn't agree with, but others we did. You know, there was no, and in fact, we tried to create lots of scientific partnerships with U.S. universities because we wanted to develop a lot of sort of scientific research agendas, including with the biogenetics of the Amazon basin. Lots, I mean, you know, there was really, we really, the United States was one of the countries I visited the most. You know, it was no visceral anti-Americanism. But clearly, there's a problem with the relationship with the United States, and that is U.S. security doctrine, I mean, essentially going back to the early 19th century, which is the Western Hemisphere for the United States, right? And the Western Hemisphere as a backyard. In the Monroe Doctrine in the early days, 1823, right, James Monroe, the Monroe Doctrine was maybe could be interpreted as an anti-colonial doctrine, right? So America's for the Americans. Well, what does that mean? Is it America's for the Americans as in we're all Americans in the Americas, or Americans for the United States Americans, right? And over time, the Monroe Doctrine became more and more Americans for the North Americans, right? It was used to prevent any other region of the world from interacting with Latin America. So certainly during the Cold War, the Soviet Union, and more recently with China. And clearly, Latin Americans should be allowed to trade with everyone, to have ties with everyone. So to bring China on board was really, really important in that sense, because, you know, we could tell, this is how much our products are worth, you know, instead of sending them to, I mean, just to give you an example, in the mid-1990s, Ecuador probably exported, in the early 90s, Ecuador exported 85% of its exports went to the United States. Now it's more like 35%, right? Still very important, and it's a key trading partner, but that dependency has, you know, there's been a great diversification, and that is good for Ecuador, and that is good for Latin America. So, I mean, that was probably the key thinking. Also in terms of liquidity, right? China has a lot of liquidity. In fact, over the recent years, it's had more liquidity than the United States. So that was key in terms of, developing certain areas of our economy, getting joint ventures, but also loans, but also for economic reasons, it was very interesting. The other thing which I think is important is that China imposes less conditionalities in every single sense of the word. So I'm not saying China is an innocent bystander in the international system. And China has its interests, and it sometimes pushes them, you know, insistently. And you know, I'm not trying to romanticize China here, but certainly in its relations with other, it doesn't have this kind of what the French used to call mission civilisatrice, right? So to try and impose a political system or a vision of the world, whereas the United States still does, right? So If you're a leftist leader in Ecuador, you might be the best leader in history, but you're not gonna be received in the White House, right? But the moment you get some right wing dictator or someone like Lenin Moreno comes in, then it's red carpet, right? China doesn't think like that. Right? China tries to, so that is also something which is important, right? There's more respect for the political system of the other, for the sovereignty of the other, for the institutions of the other. In the United States, it's, if you're not with me, then, I'm going to fight you and I'm going to try and overthrow you and I'm going to try and... Regime change is a real constant of U.S. foreign policy. Now, there is some caution to be exerted with China too. China is still fundamentally interested in the same things as the United States, as a matter of fact, as the European Union, in terms of its trading relationship with countries from the global periphery, from the global south. So it's still looking for raw materials. And so for Latin American countries, and certainly that was our mission, who are trying to change their role in international division of labor, if you like, trying to move away from just exporting raw materials and importing everything else, who are trying to diversify our economy, and sometimes that will mean applying also protectionist policies in order to develop vulnerable industries or to develop certain sectors without, products from the United States or China or elsewhere just killing that possibility because they're cheaper or more competitive, whatever. That sometimes requires also some approach to China. I mean, China today is quite happy signing some free trade agreements with rather similar clauses than the United States would impose, right? So those kinds of things, there you can have an approach where you say, well, China, we're interested in this, but we're not interested in that. And, you don't have to just, be 100% on board with everything China says or sign everything China proposes. And that's certainly not what we did. And in fact, we tried constantly to engage the Chinese in terms of investing in areas of our economy that were not based on the export of raw materials. China bought some of our oil, and that was probably some of the stuff that interested China, more. But in exchange, we said, okay, we'll sell you some oil, but please come and invest in this scientific project, or come and invest in this and that. So, there's no perfect solution, and I don't believe in alignment, wholesale alignment in either China or the United States. As a peripheral state, you've got to try and build your own policies. You've got to use different international actors in a way that is most convenient, most strategic, and most intelligent for you. But certainly, China has been more respectful, I would say, of institutions, political systems, and sovereignty of countries like Ecuador than the United States has been, without a doubt. Because the United States still has this doctrine that it has two great oceans that protect it in terms of its security, the Atlantic Ocean and the Pacific Oceans. That's its max, and it's great. It gives it a lot of security. It even gives it times, like physical minutes in order to stop an aggression, a missile or whatever. Right. But that condition only works if the Western Hemisphere is literally pacified. And unfortunately, pacification has not been through always the tools of consensus and respect and mutual recognition, and sometimes literally through kind of bully tactics of I will be your boss, and that is going to work less and less in this century with other actors on board such as China but also others, and I think that this is a parenthesis we're living now with this lawfare we were talking about and this kind of return of a very aggressive neoliberal right. But by and large, what we saw in the first decade and a half of the 21st century is more likely to be the norm in the 21st century for Latin America than the exception, because it's in Latin America's interest to diversify its tie and not be sort of under the, control or domination of the U.S. hegemon.
That's a really inspiring note to leave on. And I just want to ask you one more question that is I was going to say it's short, but this is a complex question, but maybe just briefly speak to, as Latin America develops this strategy and hopefully returns to the pink tide in terms of independence and developing a left project, what role does protecting ecology or environmental strategy play in that as well?
Yeah, so that actually ties in with your previous question, yeah, because China is sometimes being accused of just wanting raw materials and not caring too much about the ecology. That's kind of a line that's being pushed as well by the U.S., but I can assure you quite a lot of U.S. Multinationals, transnational corporations have not cared at all about the ecology.
Really? But Chevron wasn't contributing to the Ecuadorian well-being of the Ecuadorian?
I was just about to say that. The biggest ecological environmental disaster in Ecuador was a U.S. corporation, not a Chinese corporation, right? But yeah, I mean, I think in the process of wanting cheap raw materials, whether these be minerals, but also agriculture, I mean, one of the biggest, I mean, talk a lot about oil and mining. Certainly, I think mining poses a challenge, but actually the biggest threat to the Amazon rainforest right now is the expansion of the agricultural frontier, right? And it's really aggressive. And I've seen it a lot flying on helicopters over the Amazon and stuff when I was, you know, in government. You can see how much, and an oil well is not very pretty. You know, there's a hole in the jungle or the size of a soccer field, if you like, with a little flame coming out from the oil well. And, you know, it's not pretty, but it's nowhere comparable to the African palm oil plantations, right? Going all the way up to the horizon. You can't see the end of them. You know, these palm trees, monoculture that have been, they're growing where you used to have pristine rainforest, right? And so that is a major challenge. I think it has to be part of the leftist project in Latin America. I think it was in some parts, but I think it needs to be more so. There were so many urgent social needs, and there was so much need for infrastructure, for basic infrastructure, some basic, elementary growth, and some basic elementary electricity and, you know, some basic road network and some basic schools and hospitals and things like that, you know, made out of concrete that we needed to build for our people, that maybe the environmental discourse was not top of the agenda, but a bit too far down in the 10 points and our 10 key points. And that needs to be back at the forefront. And I think, I think that's the kinds of things that need to be at the top of the agenda of the left in Latin America, which is one of the most environmentally diverse regions in the world. And I actually think that exploiting our environment in a sustainable way is key to changing our role in the international division of labor. So, for example, exploiting the Amazon, not what is underneath the ground, but what is above the ground without cutting it down, which is exploiting the biogenetic patrimony, the heritage there of the Amazon in terms of...
Or like pharmaceutical innovation?
Exactly.
Like that?
For biotech, for pharmaceutical, for all sorts of things is part of the great qualitative shift to a new kind of knowledge economy that Latin America needs to engineer. And that has to be a key proposition of the left.
And along with that, maybe also some different agreements around protecting commons and making sure intellectual property doesn't develop in such a way that it excludes the periphery from medical innovation.
So fighting for public goods and the commons, absolutely. Right. And intellectual property is going to be the big struggle of the 21st century, even more than trade. You know?
Right.
It's clear that intellectual property is the new thing. I mean, it's the big thing we were facing as well with a lot of piracy in the Amazon, biopiracy. And, you know, if we don't protect or if we don't fight, I mean, it's probably a lot of it is too late because a lot of the species now have been identified and are being, you know, but if we don't fight in multilateral fora, for these species and these molecules and these properties to be for at the service of our development and the development of our peoples, then you know it's going to be a new wave of colonial accumulation of capital, right? I mean, so that's absolutely where the fight is at, and it's entirely compatible with a pro-environment worldview. Which protects the planet from climate change and all these things. So I think that is the new, I mean, it was already actually a part of our political process, but there were so many other basic elementary things that had to do with redistribution that had to be done that it wasn't always as visible. And I think it certainly has to be the priority from now on. Yeah.
Oh, Guillermo Long, that's just really, really great. I really, really appreciate your time. Everybody, of course, there's links. You can follow Guillermo on Twitter, follow his work at the Center for Economic and Policy Research, which is actually does very good work on domestic economics. And you could read Dean Baker there. But it's the indispensable place in D.C. for following U.S. foreign policy, U.S. policy in Latin America. So, Guillermo, really appreciate your time.
Oh, thank you very much for having me on your show.
Thanks so much. Take care. All right, guys, are we, I don't know if we're clear. Yep. I guess we're not clear. There's no breaks until the big break, right?
No breaks till the big break.
No breaks till the big break. Connectivity seems pretty good.
Oh, yeah. This is from the cloud, so it's not relying on any of us. So if one of us goes down, it stays up.
Wow. Yeah. FNA. All right. Become a member of the Majority Report today. majority.fm/become a member. Subscribe on YouTube. Check out justcoffee.coop. Fair trade tea, coffee, or chocolate. On Tuesday, on the Michael Brooks Show, we interviewed Torrey F. Reed, who has a great book called Towards Freedom, The Case Against Race Reductionism. This is a really, really brilliant history of black labor organizing, the New Deal, the Great Society, and then everything basically from Reaganism through Obama. Then Doris Polo and I talked about U.S. imperialism in the Caribbean, CARICOM nations trying to, in right now, even with this U.S. aggression against Venezuela, and even as the United States is literally stealing, the Trump administration is stealing COVID-19 testing kits and ventilators that are headed to Jamaica, Barbados, Grenada. It's extraordinary. And so we've talked about the leadership of an example of Mia Motley, who's very, very, she's an incredibly impressive prime minister of Barbados. Tonight, Daniel Bester and I are live streaming on why we cannot have a new Cold War with China. And we're doing a kind of physical infrastructure of U.S. based presence and military presence across the world. And you know, there's just a ton of work there. Catch up with the interviews with Cornel West and Adolf Reed. Patreon.com/TMBS. And of course, Michael Brooks Show on YouTube, where, you know, 3 clips a day, tons of live streams, lots of stuff going on. So check it all out. And you can go to Red Emma's and buy Against the Web, Cosmopolitan Answer to the New Right, and then go write a 5-star review of it on Amazon. Jamie, what's up?
Oh, hello.
Hello.
How's everybody doing?
Good. You're a little bit quiet.
Yeah, I can't hear her too well.
Should I turn myself up a little bit? How about like that?
That's better. That's better, yeah.
Better?
There you go.
All right, excellent. Yeah, it's live television, folks. So this week on the Antifada, this episode came out yesterday, and I'm very excited about it. We had on the super smart Marxist, Assad Haider. We already had on his brother, Shujo. We're just working our way through the Haider family, I guess. We talked about so many things. We did a little Bernie postmortem from a Marxist perspective using the lens of depoliticization, which I think is a really interesting lens that he wrote about in Viewpoint magazine. We talked about mass politics versus subculture politics and the problems with that framework of looking at things, the necessity of abolishing markets, the party question, and our favorite thing besides communism, punk rock. So check that out, folks. Patreon.com/TheAntifada. Also, I'm very excited to announce later today, Andy and I will be moderating a panel on coronavirus and the future of work for Red May Seattle. Obviously, we're not in Seattle right now, but we're doing it virtually, and that is at 9 p.m. Eastern. I screwed up the time before because they are on the West Coast. So it's at 6 p.m. West Coast time, 9 p.m. East Coast time. And I'm very, very excited to talk with these people about some of the things that they've written. Magali Miranda wrote a great piece about domestic laborers and their struggle to organize for their rights. Annie McClanahan wrote something about the future of logistics. And Aaron Banana wrote about automation and kind of wrote a critique of the left UBI as like non-reformist reform or the capitalist road to communism that I think is very compelling and sidesteps a lot of the vulgar workerism that we've seen from other critiques. So I'm very excited and kind of nervous to talk to these people at 9 p.m. tonight, and I'll put a link in the blog post.
Yeah, literary hangover last night. I finished my playthrough of Half-Life 2 while listening to 1984. And it was like sort of the Dark Side Sweet. Of the Moon. What's that combination of Dark Side of the Moon?
Wizard of Oz,
yeah, they synced up together. The climaxes of both the book and the game happened basically at the same time, which I wasn't expecting. So I wrapped both of those up. So I'm going to be doing future playthroughs like that. I mean, all sorts of books. Probably listen to some Karl Kautsky on communism in Central Europe while I play Kingdom Come Deliverance. So twitch.tv/literary hangover, folks, subscribe to me there.
Oh, I'm sorry, guys. One other thing real quick. At 3 o'clock, so in a little over an hour and a half, DM 25, which is basically Democracy in Europe TV, which is their YouTube channel. I'm going to be on a panel with David Adler, Grace Blakely, and Shreko Horvat, and I'm looking forward to that. That'll be fun. So go over there and, in general, subscribe. That's another one of these very good channels with a European twist. All right, folks, we'll see you in the fun half.
Left is best. Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer. You don't-